The following presentation was recorded at the Mentoring Learners Workshop at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
We're here on a morning. The Father love is reigning over us. I think, just got a picture there as we were singing that, of the many days since time began when somebody, and in fact many, many people every day in God's kingdom, set out to do something. And we're here this morning to talk about a part of the kingdom and what God wants us to do. And we're here to talk about mentoring. You know, we've heard this weekend about what mentoring is. We've thought about who the mentor is. We've looked at who the mentoree is. Now we want to look at what it takes to make it happen. Whenever I do a weekend like this, I dig through notes and lists that I've made. And one of the things I've tried to do is compile a list of people who have made a significant impact in my life. And it never fails as I reflect and look over that list. I'm just moved to tears many times at how incredibly good God has been to me in placing the people in my life and pushing me in the directions they have, and realizing how critical, how important, how life-changing those moments have been. And I want to convey to you a little bit of the vision this morning for mentoring, making it happen. F.B. Meyer tells the story of a little girl whose family stayed in a Norwegian hotel. And he was there for a few nights in a certain town there. And every morning this little girl would get up very bright and early before most of the rest were up. And she would go down to the hotel lobby and play a little melody on the piano. And of course the entire hotel, with the nature of the setup of the rooms, got to hear the broken melody being plunked out on the keyboard early hour of the day. Well, as this continued, guests were irritated, frustrated, thought of complaining, but the playing continued. One night, a famous Norwegian pianist came to stay in the hotel, and the next morning, as it always happened, the little girl was playing on the piano. But he, instead of lying in bed gritting his teeth, he got up, dressed quickly, went down, asked the little girl to sit on his lap to play, and while she played her little melody, he filled in around it and under it and created beautiful harmonies and enhanced her melody. And I think that's a beautiful picture of what God is doing in us. We're created for a unique reason, purpose, and we try to play our little melody the best we can. And the amazing thing is that God comes, asks us to sit on his lap, if you will, and plays around our little melody, supports it, enhances it, beautifies it, and it makes a difference in the world. Several years ago, I heard the story of a group of climbers that died while climbing Mount Everest. And of course, a couple guides were with the group and they died as well. Well, the media was interviewing another mountain climbing guide, and they asked him the question, could the guides have made it if they were by themselves and not with a more inexperienced group of climbers? And the guide answered, he said, oh, certainly, no problem. They could have made it. They could have gotten back. They wouldn't have had to die. But he said, you don't understand. They died taking people to a higher level. Well, when I heard that story, I said, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to die taking people to a higher level. And I want to convey that vision to you this morning. My simple theme this morning is you can do it. You can do it. Mentoring, I believe, is for everyone. And we give it a name that isn't in Scripture, but we talked about it yesterday, that it really happens in strong relationships whenever they are there. We talk about it because we want to make it more intentional. I want to look, first of all, at some foundations for the mentoring experience, and we'll look at six strategies for mentoring. Some of this is a little bit of review from the weekend. I just want to reinforce some of them, thinking about actually making it happen. Number one, I believe we need to pray. And we heard about this, but it really is true that if you want God to do something in your life, you need to begin to ask. You need to begin to seek it. Proverbs 2 says that unless you seek for wisdom, like gold and silver, like hidden treasure, you're not going to find it. And we need to get serious about wanting to grow. That is the bottom line. We need to get serious about wanting to build the kingdom. It won't happen if we just sit around and hope something happens. We need to pray and seek. Secondly, you don't have to take it all in one big chunk. You can set up low-risk opportunities for interaction. You set up low-risk opportunities for interaction. This is where you invite some people over to your house for an evening meal or a cookout or just to play some games. And you invite some people that you think, you know, I might want to get to know these people. Let's just do something tonight. And you simply see if something happens. Perhaps you strike a chemistry with somebody. Number three, you can invite a likely prospect to join you informally. So let's say you think, well, you know, this person and I, we kind of hit it off. I'd like to do something with this person. Again, you're not going to go up to them and say, I'd like to suggest that you and I study the book of John together for the next 3 months. That might be a little intimidating. Well, what you need to do is just enjoy an activity together. Perhaps you could do a work project. You could go bat balls down at the little park. Practice doing that. You could go shopping together. Just enjoy an activity that's low-key, but again, offers you the opportunity to spend some time together. Any number of things we could mention in there. You could buy them a cup of coffee. Maybe as simple as buying a cup of coffee and saying, look, let's talk. The bottom line is you spend time. You spend time with this person. That is what develops relationship. Mentoring will not happen outside of a relationship. We cannot forget that. So you're down over coffee. What do? Well, you can ask some questions. And this is after you've perhaps gotten to know this person a little bit, and you say, you know, I've been wondering, what would you like to do with your life? What would you like to do with your life? Or you seem to be really interested in such and such. Tell me about that. What else are you interested in? What are you good at? Tell me a little bit of your history. So what was it like to grow up in your town? I heard a man this last summer, an older man, was talking about how he got to know his dad, and he began to understand some dynamics in his family. And his dad had grown up in the little town of Durango, Colorado, in the years of the Depression. He says, he was telling me the story. He says, you know, I sat down and I said, Dad, what was it like? His dad's 75 years old. He said, Dad, what was it like to grow up in Durango? And his dad started to talk about what it was like. And it was an amazing moment. Start out with a simple little question. Dad, what was it like to grow up in Durango? Or ask him to tell you about their family. And this can be sort of a surprise question. Do you have faith in God? Tell me about it. But we're establishing a relationship. And just as a review again, remember, if that develops and you decide to meet, you want to make sure that you have clear expectations. You may say, hey, let's meet for lunch next Tuesday. Oh, okay, sure. What do you want to talk about? Well, I want to talk about this little project I have going here. I want some input. And you say, oh, sure. Listen, I've got an hour and a half. Will that be enough? Sure. Okay, we'll meet. Very informal. You didn't sit down and write down a contract. But you see what happened there? You said, yes, I have an hour and a half. What do you want to talk about? That. Okay, we'll meet to talk about that. And you're all set. You have some expectations. Nobody's going to be too surprised. You've decided where you're going to meet, and you're ready to go. Second thing you need to think about is the agenda. And this isn't in your notes, by the way. I'm just tossing this in here. The agenda, what are we going to do? How are we going to measure the progress? We're going to meet once. You're going to meet three times. And remember, as a mentor, let the mentoree drive the agenda. I've spent far too many hours with people trying to tell them what I thought they should learn, instead of letting them talk long enough before I began to hear what they really wanted, and I began to determine if I could really have much to say, or perhaps I didn't have anything to say and needed to talk to someone else. And then the mentor's responsibility is to simply facilitate growth. You help shape the agenda. You just help this person grow in the areas they want to grow. And it's in those places that you as a mentor have the opportunity to toss in a few ideas that may be helpful the mentoree may not have thought about. Well, these are some foundations for mentoring experiences. I want to look now at six different strategies that you can use to actually make it happen. And I present them as different strategies because there are many ways that you can mentor. Mentoring will be, the best mentoring will be a unique experience, be unique to you. It will be autobiographical, if I can use that term. It will be about you. It'll come through your life. So it's not going to look like the next person's, but it's going to come through your life. And so you have to look at these strategies and say, what's going to work for me? Some of them can be combined, but any number of them may work very well. I want to start from the very simple approach. You can do, or you can ask two very simple questions. Ask two questions. What are your priorities? How can I help? Now, those two questions are very freeing because I don't sit down trying to stack up a lot of answers, a lot of solutions, a lot of ways to make life work. I just ask a couple questions. What are your priorities? How can I help? As a young person or as a new teacher, a new principal, a leader in some area, these questions are incredibly encouraging. Someone sits down, actually takes the time, shows the interest to say, what are your priorities? How can I help? That's tremendously encouraging. It says, I'm not alone. As I was thinking about this, I thought, you know, let's just suppose even that was frightening to me. Let's say I've never mentored anyone. And let's say I'm thinking, well, what if he says how I can help? And I'm like, I don't think I can help. That's the worst thing that could happen. Well, remember that you still took the time to ask. You took the time to listen. You cared. That alone can make all the difference. Another strategy, you tell them two things. You tell them two things. You tell them where you've been, and you tell them that they can go there too. For some people, their most immediate need is hope and vision. They think that life is hopeless. They have no idea that they could actually achieve anything. They feel trapped. Their family situation might be such that they're just waiting for their dad to do something else that will make the whole community stand back and shake their heads. They're just wondering what's going to happen next to make my family or to make me look like a failure. Well, you can sit down and say, let me tell you where I've been. And when you're done, you can say, and you know what? Here's the neat thing. You can go there too. I've been where you are. And that may be the greatest surprise of their life. They may look at you and say, you know, if my life could be that good, I'd have it made. But you can dispel some of that illusion and help them see that they can move to the same place. Too often, people see where we are and they don't see where we've come from, and they need to get a picture of what that process is like to go from here to here. And you can help them do that by simply telling them where you've been, and they can go there too. A third model is to ask three fundamental questions, or to see the mentoring process as answering three fundamental questions. And this model is really for someone who is probably more experienced and especially knowledgeable in some of these areas. But take a look at it. I think it puts the mentoring experience in a great perspective, especially spiritual mentoring. Number one, answer the question, who is God? And this is really all about developing intimacy with God. developing intimacy with God. And so, as a mentor, to answer this question, you're going to have to do a lot of listening to this person's story, because you want to help them see where God has been at work in their life, where they may think that God's been far off the entire time. But you're helping them develop an intimacy with God by helping them answer the question, who is God? Where has He been in my life? Secondly, you help them answer the question, who am I? Who am I? And this is about finding my identity as a loved child of God. Finding my identity as a loved child of God. Learning to hear God in the rest of my story, the rest in the story of my life. And then number three, what is my unique voice? All we're trying to do here is determine some answers or some perspectives to the fact that, you know, why was I born in 1964 in America to the parents that I was born to in the church? Why have I met these people in my life? Why have I had this particular set of experiences? Why am I good at this and not good at that? What is my unique voice? Why did God put me here? And can I help encourage this person to go ahead and step into that role that God seems to have sovereignly created for them and encourage them to fill it? In other words, give them the courage to play their little melody, if I can refer to that incident at the beginning. Play their melody and allow God to fill in around it. What is my unique voice? Another strategy, especially as you say, okay, we're going to meet at Country Table now every other Friday morning for coffee at 6 o'clock. And you say, okay, we're going to meet. And as a mentor, you might be shaking your boots and say, what in the world are we going to talk about? We're going to sit down, we're going to drink this coffee or hot chocolate or whatever you like to drink at that hour of the morning. And what are we going to talk about? Well, Bob Beal in his book, Mentoring, gives us six things that we can talk about. And in his book, he primarily focuses on a more business occupational mentoring style. But they're still helpful for us to think about. Number one, pressing decisions. Pressing decisions. We can talk about the issues they're facing. Simply having someone who will be a sounding board can be tremendously helpful. Number two, we talk about problems in reaching priorities. Remember, we've asked the question maybe, what are your priorities? How can I help? So we begin to work on those. And so we just talk about problems that we're having in meeting those priorities. Number three, we discuss plans. We discuss plans. And here, the mentor really does need to know what the mentoree has in mind. What are you planning on doing? Well, by next year I'd like to do this, or next month I have this going, and here's what I need to do. And this is all in the context of where we're going with priorities and trying to help the mentoree. But we discuss plans. And then we look at progress points. And here, I just had this happen here recently. Someone who I hadn't really mentored that directly, but we would talk periodically about important issues in this person's life, came to me recently and just say, hey, you know, here's what's happening in my life. And it's something I've been looking for a long time, and it's starting to happen. All I could do is just say, great, fantastic, I'm excited for you. That's what we're doing here. Just talking about progress points and getting excited about them. Number five, prayer requests. Prayer requests. Great opportunity to pray with people. And number six, personal roadblocks. What is blocking my progress? And as a mentor, you can perhaps help him or her think clearly about the issues. A fifth strategy, and this really is more overarching. It can really be blended into any of them, but we provide higher level experiences. One of the most powerful things we can do for a mentoree is to provide actual involvement. If you remember the story I told yesterday morning about the man who told me to go home and spend an hour with my son, notice he didn't just preach at me about needing to spend more time with my family. He encapsulated it in a little project. He gave me an assignment. He said, look, you go home and spend an hour tomorrow night And I knew I'd see him the next evening at that meeting. And I knew he was the kind of guy who just probably going to ask me how it went. Well, he gave me an assignment. So he was providing a higher level learning experience there. And these experiences just whet our appetite, broaden our horizons. It may be helpful for us to think about how people learn. Often we are mentoring adults, and adults generally learn a bit differently. The motivations they have for learning are a little different than children. And Malcolm Knowles has identified four principles that are unique to adult learning. I just want to share them with you. These are not in your notes. But adults generally have a deep need for self-directed learning. Self-directed learning. Here again, it's where you let the mentoree set the agenda. You're going to be a long way down the road to having something good happen if you let the mentoree say, here's what I want to learn. Here's where I want to grow. Okay, well, let's talk about that. Let's set up experiences, assignments for self-directed learning. Notice my mentor didn't take me and sit me down and show me how to play with my son. He said, here, go do it. Go do it. Number two, adults increasingly appreciate learning that takes place through experience. They appreciate learning that takes place through experience. And here's why. Experience draws on what we already know. It may be a brand new experience, but all I can do when I come to that experience is draw on what I already know, apply it to this new experience, and that stimulates me. It makes me think. It makes me be creative. And that's exciting. Number three, the learning readiness of adults rises primarily from the need to accomplish tasks and solve problems that real life creates. Isn't that why we're wanting to be mentored? We're in real life and we're stuck somewhere. Or we would like to be better. We'd like to grow. And so this is real life. Help me out. Help me solve some real life problems. Don't talk to me about, you know, what will happen when I'm 45 if I'm only 25. Talk to me about what I need to do at 25. And then number four, adults see learning as a process through which they can raise their competence in order to reach full potential in their lives. I say it again and again, but the most exciting thing about mentoring is to watch a person of potential just accelerate under the direction or tutelage or motivation, inspiration, encouragement of someone else. We watch people. I think of Joseph. I've often marveled at the gigantic leap that he took from being in a dungeon to being second in command of all Egypt. But he really had some mentoring experiences. They were profound. They were difficult. They were real life. But notice, in each situation, whether it was Potiphar, you know that Potiphar trained him. And he learned a lot in the household of a man who was in charge of a lot of people. He learned a lot in the dungeon. It was a whole different set of experiences, a whole different set of lessons, but you know he learned a lot. And when he stepped into second in command of Egypt, I marvel at his assertiveness, the way he stepped right in and pulled it off. Well, that's what we want as a mentor. We want to learn today. Maximize what I need to learn now and prepare me for more tomorrow. Well, what are these higher level experiences? Number one, meet regularly to discuss their life. Now, this sounds so simple, but think about it. How often have you sat down with somebody and just discussed your life? We discuss the weather, we discuss the news, we discuss work. But we seldom sit down to discuss our lives. Number two, take them with you. Let them watch you at work. This can be intimidating. See, I'm not sure I want someone else around me to watch how I do things. But it's a tremendous way to give them an opportunity to learn. Number three, recommend books. You may have read things they haven't heard about. Number four, recommend tapes. Number five, attend conferences. I'm convinced that we too easily become ingrown. And simply do not push ourselves, do not get out to hear what other people are saying about issues in life. There's something very powerful to be said about focusing on your own growth and contemplation and times away. It can also be very stretching to get outside of your own little circle and hear what other people are saying. Number six, meet people. Just get out and meet people. Again, I marvel at how many of my friends at home have very few social experiences outside of their own family and church, and primarily just their own family. They come from a large family. They've always lived in that community. They have lots of aunts and uncles, lots of brothers and sisters, and they may have a tradition of getting together as an extended family every Saturday night, enjoying pizza. Well, that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But you will only grow this much if that's all that your social contact is. You're going to have to expand it if you're going to want to grow. Number seven, you can pray with them. And this is more than just praying, God, thanks for today, even though that's important. But this is praying with them about the struggles, praying with them about their dreams, about their goals, about what's going well or what's not going well, drawing them into a relationship with God. A pastor friend shared a plan with me, and this is this plan for discipleship, this sixth strategy I want to look at. He shared with me several years ago, and I'm going to be sharing it primarily the way he shared it with me. I haven't had a lot of opportunity to use it, simply because it's often for new believers. And one of this man's gifts was bringing people to Christ. And he would often use this model to talk to them about what it was, what it meant to be a Christian. And I like it because it's very simple, and yet it addresses key issues. I'm going to give you a visual cue. I just want to pull you in a little bit here to this morning. Give you a visual cue for each one of these stages as I talk about it, and then at the end I want to ask you to do it with me. Number one is Jesus. We're going to start in the middle. This person is a new believer or has just come to Christ, and you're going to talk to them about who Jesus is. And primarily what we're looking at here is the realization that I need a relationship with Jesus Christ. What does it mean to have a relationship? And as a good friend of mine used to always say, he'd look at me and says, brother, he says, I need Jesus. I need Jesus. And so the cue for this one is, I need you, Jesus. I need you, Jesus. What is he? Who is he? What is salvation? What does it mean to know him? What does it mean to abide in him? What does his suffering, death, and life mean to me? Leanne Payne says that every person, in order to know what it means to be a Christian, to have their life restored to wholeness, they need to know what it means to receive forgiveness. They need to know what it means to forgive others. They need to know what it means to accept themselves for who God has made them to be. And so a person needs to establish a relationship with Jesus Christ that is at the center of all they do. Number two is worship and prayer. C.S. Lewis says that we are just like animals in the sense that our physical posture bearing reflects what is really going on inside. He gives the example of a dog. How does a dog show submission to another dog or even to his master? You've seen them. The head's down, the tail's in, and they just fawn. And it looks like a very weak position. It's a very servile, submissive position. And Lewis says, you know, people are just like that. And he says, we're foolish to think that the old position of folding our hands to pray is really unnecessary. It doesn't really mean anything. You know, I can sit anywhere and pray, right? Well, sure, I can. But the cue for this one, I'd like to have you do it with your hands beseechingly and bow your head. And while you do that, I want you to think about what has to be true if that's really what you are feeling at that moment. I want you to do that in your mind before the Lord here. Fold your hands like this. You're beseeching, and you bow your head. Try it. Okay, how strong, how bold, how aggressive do you feel doing that? Not very. It's a very humble. Now, we're not used to kings and queens, but you know, that's Esther coming in to touch the king's scepter. That's really what the Bible talks about when it talks about men falling on their face before the Lord. Try that sometime in your bedroom. Fall flat out on the floor and say, God, I need you. Now that is worship. And listen to what is true about your heart. We take that position. I'm convinced too many of us don't know how to worship. We sit in church, we sing the obligatory song, we say the obligatory prayer, and none of that internal reality ever takes place that would take place if we were to kneel in complete helplessness. Say, God, help me. Number three, we teach the person what it means to fellowship. And this is going to be a little interesting this morning, but I want you to turn to the person next to you, and you may not want to put your arm around them, depending who it is, but put your arm around them and look at them. That's the posture for this one. Fellowship and caring. I put my arm around, and I look at the person in the face. All right? Well, it's interesting that the word person comes from the Greek word persipon. I think I pronounced that correctly. And really what it means is face to face. The idea is that we're really not persons until we look another person in the face. That's what it means to fellowship and to care. And so in this phase, the mentor may take the mentoree and look at passages like Philippians 2, that I want to have the mind of Christ. I want to be humble. To look at the two greatest commandments and say, this is the essence of what it means to be a Christian. Love God, heart, soul, mind, and strength, neighbor as yourself. You may look at Romans 12. Esteem other people more highly than yourself. You read the great stories of Scripture, the great relationships, David and Jonathan, and others that demonstrate true fellowship, true selflessness, true caring. It may be an assignment, like participating in a Bible study or a discussion group or a work project. Number four is nurture and training. Nurture and training. And the visual cue for this is to put your hand on the shoulder of the person facing you. You nurture and you train. You equip that person. Here we look at the nurturing and equipping of gifts and abilities that God has given this person. We're getting to know this person. We begin to see what God has placed in them, and we begin to nurture those things. We begin to teach and train them to use those gifts. And Ephesians 4 here really gives us a picture. The equipping of the saints till the whole body becomes a building. And we begin to discuss lifestyle, vocation. What should I do with my life? And then number five is witness and service. The visual cue for this one is to extend a cup of water. Here's something that I'm offering from my life to you. How am I going to use who I am, what God has given me in service and in building the kingdom? And this really is an extension of vocation, giftings, abilities, personal call. What is God calling me to do with my life? How do I share what I have, both in telling and in serving? And this could include work projects, mission experiences, prison ministry, other leadership and service opportunities. Well, let's go over these. I want you to do them with me.
All right, so first of all, I'm going to say, Jesus, I need you. Let's do that. Jesus, I need you. And then we go to worship and prayer. And then we go to fellowship and caring. Have fun. Hey, that's great. Actually, do it. All right, and then we go to nurture and training. I put my hand on the person's shoulder and say, here's what you can do. All right, put it out front of you, look them in the face. By the way, if you ever have the tremendous privilege of having someone do that to you, you need to give that gift to someone else. It's an incredible gift. And then number five, witness and service. And I extend what I have, what God has given to me, and I give it to you, the cup of water. This same pastor friend gave me another model that I have used a few times. And it's called a personal prognosis. And I'll just run through this briefly. And I put a stack of about 25 of these on the back table if you care to pick one up. Here, we just begin to answer a few questions and think about our life as a whole. And this probably isn't something you'd start off with if you're mentoring someone. You're probably not going to start off with this because this assumes that you have some relationship. This assumes that you know some things about this person that help you, help them think through these areas. And here we begin by answering the question, what would be God, I have the wrong sheet here. We begin by looking at ourselves. What is important to you? What's important to you? And here I tell the person, don't tell me what you think ought to be important. Don't give me a list that is just cookie cutter perfect as to what's important to you, because we all know we're not there. I'm not there. You're not there. Let's just be honest about what is important. Take a look at your life. Look at your schedule. Look at what you spend the most time doing. Look at what is the most exciting, most fun, most rewarding for you, and list them in order. What's important? Number one. And then say why it's important to you. After you've made that list, answer this question. From that list, who is the most important person in your life? Who is it? Don't tell me that God is the most important, unless He really is. Now, I know you want Him to be. But looking at your list, who is most important? How are you showing that? Who is the second most important person in your life? How are you showing it? Who is the third most important person in your life? How are you showing it? And then I take this question, what would be God's top 10 for your life? What would be God's top 10? And let's be realistic again, but let's be honest. What would be God's top 10? And so we list them again. Now, here's the critical question. Do your list and your impression of God's list agree? Okay. Why or why not? And then let's take a look at another list. What is important to your spouse or significant other? What is important? So it could be your parents. It could be your boss at work. Let's say you have to work closely with someone else at work. Or let's say you have a very good friend, dorm mate, roommate, brother, sister, whoever you choose. But what is important to them? Again, list them. And give a reason. And then I begin to ask this question. What goals do you have for yourself for the next year? I had a friend do this last summer to me. Older man came and said, look, let's go out for supper, and I want you to bring me a list of of you'd like to accomplish in the rest of your life? Well, that's what we're doing here. What goals do you have for yourself for the next year? What's the goal? How are you going to get there? What's your strategy? What are your goals for the next 5 years? And what's your strategy? And then, here's an interesting list. What are 10 things you would like to do in your lifetime, realistically? And a new twist on that, another twist on that question would be, what are 10 things you would like to do in your life if money, time, and people were not a limitation? Wouldn't that be fun? I used to say, oh, come on, let's get real. Money will always be an issue. People will always be an issue. But, you know, it's kind of fun. And I did that. My friend asked me to do that. He looked at my list and said, you're not dreaming big enough. You're not dreaming big enough. In order to accomplish these things, what will need to characterize your life? What will need to characterize your life in order to accomplish these things? What will you need to start doing now? What kind of help will you need? And here again, you're just helping this person put together a plan for their life. Now, I know I've heard the arguments against this. The people say, oh, come on. I just want to glorify God. I'm going to live for God. I'm going to let God lead me. Well, that's a wonderful goal, but it's a little bit like a shotgun. And it dissipates energy because today I might think God's leading me this way, and next day I might think God's leading me this way. And it tends to dissipate the energy that God has placed and given in my life. And I'm not very focused. Now, it is true. I believe that the more you get to know Jesus Christ, the more focused your life will become. And it'll be a lot easier to fill that in. This is a way to ask the person to begin pursuing that kind of relationship. If you really don't know, what are you going to need to do to get there? I'm going to focus on a relationship with Jesus Christ. I want to hear what the significant people in my life have to say about what I need to grow and become a whole person. One of the burdens that I believe God has given me, I'll be honest and say I'm not sure why God has given it to me, because it's been painful. But to watch people finish the race of life and not finish well. Think about great men or women that you have seen, and they begin with great potential, especially in their 20s. In their 20s, they have energy and vision, and they have a lot of strength. John says the glory of young men is their strength. And because they don't have a lot of responsibility and they don't have a lot of people to answer to, they can get a lot done. Their raw talent is exciting. It's exciting. And so the church, the organization, life begins to pull a lot from these people. And they begin to pour themselves into whatever it is, and they can make things work. Too often, by the time they're 40 and 50 years old, things begin to cave in. They begin to implode. Things begin to collapse. And I've watched that happen. I remember it can be as simple as I stayed on a farm when I was 13 years old. For 2 weeks, a relative of my dad, I had a great time. That man was really good at providing certain family experiences. He's a dairy farmer. I had a lot of fun at that place. It was so much fun. But I watched that man just sort of go into neutral. He had vision. I rode with him. I went to places with him, watched him. We went to a farm show one day, or a sale. I'm sure you remember what it was anymore. But I just remember sitting in the car, driving to and from this place, the two-hour drive, and he was talking with another neighbor farmer that had gone with him. And they were talking about life and issues. You know, and it was important. The man had vision. But I've watched him fail with his boys. I've watched him fail. And yet when I was there as a boy, I thought, man, this would be the place to grow up. I mean, you do things all day with this guy. and it's exciting. We went fishing for a whole day, you know, it was great. But I've watched him go into neutral. And today, all he'll say, if you get talking about parenting issues, he'll just kind of shake his head at you and kind of get a cynical smile. He says, "You'll find out. You'll find out." What a painful statement. He is sidelined, and he's only 50. What's going to happen next 20 years with him unless something drastic happens? Finishing well. Why does it happen so seldom? Well, I want to tell you something, folks. I want to finish well, and I'm 35. I don't know how I'm going to finish. But it looks like something pretty tough happens between 35 and 55. What does it take to finish well? In their book, Connecting, Paul Stanley and J. Robert Clinton did a study of leaders, both historical and present leaders. They tried to determine what is it that makes these people finish well as a mentor, as a person who can bless other people in their lives, whether it's their family, whether it's people they work with, people in church. What is it? Well, number one, they determined these people had perspective. And this perspective enabled them to focus. It's like putting together a puzzle without having the box cover to look at to help you figure out where these 1,000 or 2,000 pieces go. People that have perspective see the big picture and they know where the puzzle pieces go in order to make the picture look like it's supposed to look. Number two, these people had, every one of them, had a vibrant, personal, intimate relationship with Jesus Christ. Not only that, they experienced repeated times of renewal. Remember Steve's story yesterday about Philip Yancey at 50, taking a day off to evaluate his life, and he decided there were 10 areas that he needed to grow if he was going to keep growing as a person. At 50, Howard Hendricks tells a story about a lady he knew who was never boring. She'd be 80 years old, sitting at some social function, and everybody's, you know, sitting around holding their teacup really, really nice, you know, with a little pinky turned out and talking about the weather. And he walks in and she says, "Well, tell me, Howard, what are the 5 best books you read in the last month?" You know, wow, the whole climate changes. He said that when she died at 93 years of age, she died. Her daughter said that she died asleep that night. The next morning she found on the bedside table a list that her mom had just written. It said, the goals that I want to accomplish the next 10 years of my life. She was 93. Isn't that a great story? Well, this person has a relationship with Christ, with repeated times of renewal. Melvin talked about this one yesterday. They were disciplined in important areas of life. Not in every area. And again, you don't have to be perfect. You don't have to be perfect. They said some men were highly disciplined in Bible study and prayer, but not in their diet, let's say. Other men were highly disciplined in organizational skills, time management, but not in some other area. Okay, you don't have to be perfect, but in the important areas, whatever it is you're doing, you better determine what the important areas are and be disciplined. And the fourth thing they did was they maintained a positive learning attitude all their lives. And that's where the story of this lady again is so exciting. It seems like at about the age of 40, we taper off. Our sense of need to learn and grow seems to slap off. And I've had a lot of men tell me this. And I'm close enough, I'm beginning to get a picture. You know, from 20 to 30, I was just starting to teach. I'd grown up watching my dad teach, gone to school, and read a lot about teaching, and did a little bit. But when I finally had the chance to begin teaching, I mean, I was pulling at everything I could get my hands on to learn ways to do this well. Okay, but let's say you teach for 10, 15, 20 years. Are you still pulling that hard? Chances are you're not. Now, some of that feels good. You don't have to pull that hard in the same sense, maybe desperation. But the sense, the desire of need, knowing that I need to grow, never stopping. Does that feel like work? It does if you look at the next 25, 35, 45 years. You mean I always have to be hungry to learn and grow. Start with today. The fifth thing that these men had was a network of meaningful relationships, and they had several important mentors. They were not alone. I've watched enough older men, experienced a few things myself, to know that there will be times of crisis periodically in your life. It may be the time your first child is born. It may be when you start a new job. Maybe when you move into a new community. It may be that you step into another ministry role and the expectations are higher. If you don't have key people who have enough of a relationship that they can speak into your life, you stand a very good chance of getting into trouble. Let me just show you a model of what this can look like. And again, this is from Paul Stanley and Robert Clinton. They said that every believer, every leader needs upward mentoring. They need to have a few people, and really the arrow could go down here as well. They need a few strong mentors in their life who've been there before they have and have been down the road a ways and can look back and say, well, here's, you know, have you thought about this? You know, you're going to find out that as you develop this, here's what's going to happen. You need a few people in your life who can tell you some of those things. I've often heard them, you know, people tell me that, and I'm like, how do you know that? Well, they've been there. They've walked the road. You need to have a few men that you're mentoring. A few men or women that you are mentoring. In other words, it's not all get everything I can get. You're also giving out of your life. And then you need to have some peer co-mentoring. And there's two different kinds of peer co-mentoring. One is external, outside your organization. So I'm here at Faith Builders, and there's a number of people here that I work with who mentor me, and they're really peers. But they speak into my life in different ways. I'm sorry, I'm jumping over here on the internal. But I also have some friends who don't work at Faith Builders. I have family members I stay in touch with. I have friends in different parts of the country that I call periodically. Some of them once a year, some of them once a month. But I stay in touch some way. I stay in touch. And they give me an outside perspective. And we talk about life and how it's going. And then, as I already mentioned, the internal mentor. This can be your brother or sister. This can be a person you work with. It can be a person in your church. But it's peer co-mentoring. And I'm telling you something, folks. These are more than friends that you get together to bat balls with, or you may do that, but it's not going to stop there. It's more than a friend that you go shopping with periodically or just go out and have a good time. That's part of it. But periodically you sit down and say, well, let's talk about what's going on. It can be as simple as what's going well in your life right now? What are you excited about? I'd like to hear about it. It can be what are you struggling with right now? What's a temptation? That was the question on the table for many years back home with the group of guys I met with, was the standard question every Wednesday morning was, what's one thing you've struggled with in the past week? And we could talk about a lot of other things, but we knew that was one question we were expected to answer. What's one temptation you're struggling with? Talk about a lot of things. And then the downward mentoring. Howard Hendricks has put it this way. He says, everybody needs a Paul in their life. That's if you're a Timothy, you need a Paul. Everybody needs a Barnabas. Somebody comes alongside as an encourager. Everybody needs a Timothy. Someone like Paul did, mentoring Timothy. You need a Paul, you need a Barnabas, you need a Timothy. To really have a strong network of relationships. And really, as I thought about this, these arrows could go both ways. On every category, I find that I am mentored in every way by all these people. It goes both ways. Well, the Apostle Paul was obsessed with finishing well. You could really say that he was obsessed with it. How many times do you hear him say, "I am going for it"? You read the epistles, and of course the one we're most familiar with is Philippians 3, when he said, "I count not myself to have apprehended." I'm not there yet. But this one thing I do, forgetting what is behind and reaching a continual learning posture, reaching forth unto those things which are before, I press toward the mark for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Let me suggest an action plan. Remember, I said yesterday you need to start developing a list of people who have been significant in your life. Well, I think now is the time to determine what area you need to address in your life. In other words, as you've been thinking this weekend, have you thought of some people that you would, you're thinking, I really need to get into the Word. I wonder who could help me learn how to study the Bible. Chances are, there's one person in your church or community that you could say, you don't have to ask him, "Would you mentor me?" You just say, "I really have appreciated the way that you study the Bible. It's obvious to me that you know how to study the Word. Would you mind meeting with me for a few times and helping me learn how to study? Or I can tell that you know how to pray. Could you teach me how to pray? Or I can tell that you know how to overhaul an engine. That's something I've always wanted to do. Can you teach me how to overhaul an engine?" You name it. It's that big. And I'd like you to think a little bit. What is an area that you've been thinking about? Who would you like to have mentor you? Think for a moment. One person. It may be an historical biography as well. Maybe it's a book you ought to read. Perhaps you've thought of a person or two in your church or your family, your community, who needs mentoring. And you realize that you haven't really opened your life to the possibility that God might want to use you that way in this person's life. And you need to say this morning, "God, I really do want to open myself to this possibility. I'm going to begin to develop a relationship with this person and see if anything happens. See if I can get an opportunity." I want to conclude by reading a poem about the race of life. It's a very simple poem. It's not great poetry, as poetry goes, but I love the poem. And it pictures for us some of the critical elements of mentoring. We've talked a lot of things about mentoring. Talk about being a cheerleader, a critic, an encourager, a motivator, a discipler, a coach, a model. All of these things. And this little poem is entitled "The Race." "Quit! Give up! You're beaten!" they shout at me and plead. "There's just too much against you now. This time you can't succeed." And as I start to hang my head in front of failure's face, my downward fall is broken by the memory of a race. And hope refills my weakened will as I recall that scene, for just the thought of that short race rejuvenates my being. A children's race. Young boys, young men, how I remember well. Excitement, sure, but also fear. It wasn't hard to tell. They all lined up so full of hope, each thought to win that race, or tie for first, or if not that, at least take second place. And fathers watched them from the side, each cheering for his son, And each boy hoped to show his dad that he would be the one. The whistle blew and off they went, young hearts and hopes afire, to win and be the hero there, was each young boy's desire. And one boy...
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit ChristianLearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the DocForLearning.org.